From the heart of the Kootenays, this is the Friends of Kootenay Lake podcast series, Voices of the Lake, a podcast that will familiarize you with common terms, concepts, and strategies relating to the conservation, enhancement, or restoration of ecosystems around Kootenay Lake. I'm today's host, Kayla Tillipaw, broadcasting from the traditional territories of the Tunaha, the Sinaichkst, the Sahuatmk, and Seal First Nations. Today I'm speaking with Norm Allard, community planner for the Yakanuki Lower Kootenay Band. Over the last few years, Norm has been heavily involved in a number of wetland restoration projects on the reserve.
Back in October, Kayla and I were lucky enough to get a tour of the Yakanuki wetlands in Creston. We were interested in taking this particular tour because we wanted to know more about wetland restoration techniques, and any excuse to go to Creston is a good one. Norm Allard, who has managed this huge restoration project, was our tour guide. And he offered such an engaging and introspective tour.
Norm is a bit of a technical genius who has this crazy ability to visualize and understand the hydrodynamics of water moving through a system as it's being mechanically altered, and how those hydrological changes will impact adjacent living systems. Like a sponge, he picks up information from experts he works with and uses that information to improve his work, all while developing a clearer picture of the interconnectedness of all these systems. This conversation puts you in the mind of a wetland restoration designer and provides insight on the really complex process of enhancing and restoring ecosystems. Norm also explains the value of this work to the Yakanuki community and how this work has far-reaching impacts across the landscape.
As we walked around this huge wetland space and Norm described the history of the wetland, the work that had been done, and the work that was planned for the future, it really became apparent that what was happening here is truly significant and in many ways trailblazing. I can really see this project sitting as a model for how to restore wetland habitat on a large scale, and we're so excited to see how this project develops and grows over time.
The song in this episode is called Sliver of Sunshine by Born on a Wednesday. The song is about the changing of seasons and a changing of perspectives. You can hear more music from Born on a Wednesday on Spotify, Bandcamp, or on their website, bornonawednesday.com. You can also follow them on Instagram, Born on a Wednesday Music. Thanks so much, guys. We love your stuff, and we really appreciate your contribution to our podcast. I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to be here today and to have this conversation with me. I appreciate it so much.
Thanks for having me. Always fun for me to be able to talk and share some of the stuff we've been doing. So I'm glad that you guys invited us to and give us just yet another avenue to kind of spread some of the work we've been doing in restoration. So,
of course. Awesome. So the first question's a bit of an icebreaker question. So what was your last experience or adventure on or around Kootenay Lake, or your local lake if you haven't been to the Kootenay Lake in a while?
Probably a few months ago. My father-in-law has a boat. We took my wife and my two daughters out and we did a bit of fishing. We caught a couple nice little trout from the lake, rainbow trout. And it was my eldest daughter, she's six, her first time. We kind of let her reel it in with a little bit of help. So yeah, that's kind of the most recent stuff.
That sounds like a really fun bonding experience with the family. Thanks for sharing. Could you tell me a little bit about yourself and the work that you do?
Well, my name's Norm Allard. I'm community planner for Lower Kootenay Band. Currently, I'm working on a number of restoration wetland projects on the reserve. I do take care of some of the social media of the band as well. Land use plan, I've been working a bit with the community comprehensive plan. It's mostly restoration work that I've been working on. And with every other department as well, I kind of help them out with certain things. I do a lot of GIS work for the band. I'm basically involved with anything that's going on down there in some way.
Cool. Yeah, it sounds like you've been keeping busy. So how did you get involved working at the Yakanuki wetlands?
First was there was a society called the Friends of the Yakunuki Wetlands, and they were taking care of all the infrastructure that was down there and doing what they could to get the wetlands functioning within all of these impoundments that had been put in. And they all reached in retirement age and were wanting to kind of get away from that. So, and they couldn't find anyone else to take over the society, so they dissolved it and handed care of the wetlands back to the band. And I kind of got a crash course on how to run all the infrastructure and pumps and gates, like valves on culverts, in order to get water flowing to these different compartments. And I took care of that for about a year. And about a year after that, I was introduced to Tom Beibighauser, who's into restoring wetlands. And from there, we just put together a few designs and started the work in probably 2017.
Cool. We've worked with Tom Beibighauser in the past for a 2014 Harrop Wetland Restoration Project. That sounds like a lot to really get caught up on and take a crash course on in such a short amount of time. Big responsibility.
Yeah. Oh, it's been fun. Like, in fully reconnecting these areas, these wetlands were actually floodplain as well. So with my GIS background and Tom's a bit tech savvy as well, I was able to help him out with some of his design and bring him new tools. We've been using the oldest photos we could find. I geo-referenced them. We're able to put them in Avenza and use those photos right directly in the field to find all these historical wetlands. And from there, we kind of went through an evolution of a technique on how to restore wetland from all of those historical photos and seeing what had been done since then and how to get it back to as close to functioning as possible. We started out digging basically in fields of canary reed. And then by the time we moved on to the second phases of our projects, we had that tech. And from there, we could start seeing how the land actually was changing around these old historical wetlands that have kind of been, because they were cut off from the floodplain, it sped up their evolution. And wetlands, they go through phases from wetland to fen to bogs and then eventually fields. By the time we got to them, they were almost at the point of being just fields. And these large historical wetlands that were just massive, they'd become ephemeral and only held water a little bit of the year, whereas before, you know, they held it for a lot longer.
Wow, that must have been so cool to go out there with those georeference photos of what the wetlands used to look like and look at yourself on where you're standing on the map and look around you and just see the difference in how that landscape had changed over time. That's really cool. Would you be able to provide just a brief history on the area? So like the previous land uses and previous restoration work that's taken place?
I think it was in the 70s. Our late 60s is when the construction in the area first began. Back then, the idea was they were looking at all of these nesting habitat sites on the plains, and they were trying to incorporate that within BC. Whereas the Creston Valley here was a huge staging area for migratory birds. And in creating these compounds, they were cutting them off from the floodplain in order to protect and build nesting habitat for these birds. And they built probably about 8 or 9 impoundments on the reserve with diking. And these areas were kind of built like bathtubs so they could be filled and drained at will. All of the historical wetlands were connected with level ditching. And this broke the rim of those wetlands so that they could drain all like these massive areas. Some of them are 290 acres or so out of water, so they could do more work within the area. And they built like these massive nesting islands. Some of them were, I think, by 18 by 24 meters by up to 3 meters high. And when everything was filled to capacity, these would function as nesting sites, but because of the way the area is, glaciers have ripped through the valley like thousands and thousands of years ago and just left different layers of clay-like material, like glacial till and sand layers and everything. So when you break through a certain layer, all of that water can disappear into a sand lens and drain out either into the river system or further down into the ground below. And because they just put a rim around these areas with the diking and using natural levees and higher elevations, they hadn't sealed off the bottom, which you kind of need to do to build a wetland that you want to hold water. So they weren't able to fill them to capacity like they wished. It started out with the idea of pumping for maybe a few weeks to a month. By the time they were done the projects, the notes and the design plans and stuff said that these pumps had to be run 365 days a year in order to keep water in there. And
Where were they pumping the water from?
The Goat River and Kootenai River.
Wow. And this was in the field tour you mentioned, this was Ducks Unlimited that did this work?
Yeah. Yeah, they came in with that idea, and you know, it did function in some areas, and it works way better on the plains, but when you bring that to BC, to these floodplains, it could work for what they intended. Like back in the day, this was the idea, and the science was like, you know, we want to create more habitat for these birds to nest in, and you know, these ideas were revolutionary back then, but since they'd cut off these floodplains there, they removed a huge interplay in between the wetlands that would flood during freshet and the river systems and creeks themselves, that there's a huge nutrient exchange that happens between both of them. Like one's rich in phosphorus and the other one is rich in nitrogen, which goes into feeding, say, like zooplankton blooms that fish are dependent on, especially during spawning time when they first hatch. They need to get all of their food that they need. And within the river systems, there's something like 10 parts per million, whereas there used to be thousands.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's just like one small little interplay between, you know, the fish and the systems for the Goat River and Kootenai Lake that the wetlands used to play a role in, that we're trying to restore that back to the system. So,
yeah, restore those nutrient levels.
Yeah.
Cool. A lot of people might not realize that something as simple as just how much nutrients a stream is bringing into a water body, and then when those nutrients collect in a wetland and then flow back out, how that completely sculpts an ecosystem, and how almost all wildlife will depend on just those nutrients, from feeding the zooplankton and then to feeding the little baby fry and then feeding the larger fish and then feeding the birds.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really connected system, and it's really cool that you're able to visualize all of that and see that big picture as you're doing this work. And that's a huge, like, I don't know, brain barrier that you kind of have to constantly be seeing through every day on the job.
I've been lucky enough to have a number of different specialists in just in different fields throughout science, I guess, come through, and they've had lots of questions about things that were going on, which kind of clued me into a lot of the interplay these things used to have. And I've had a lot of questions for them as well. So putting all this together has been a pretty mind-opening experience for me. And it's been really fun. There's a group called the International Kootenai River Habitat Restoration Team. And they put on meetings with anybody from Meander Reach down in the States up to Kootenai Lake that has a project going on. Everybody gets together and kind of shows their projects. And it's from teams like that and people that are doing other things that have been able to start learning a lot of this stuff. So basically try to learn as much as I can from each field in order to get the gist of how it interplays with the project itself and contributes to everything else that goes on.
That really goes to show the importance of that community engagement and the community working together. Speaking of which, on the site tour, you spoke about how the Yakanuki are wetland people. Can you explain a bit about what that means and what this project means to your community? So you can talk about the community involvement that it might be bringing about or the values to the community.
So the whole valley bottom used to be a floodplain. There's historical photos that were taken from the border that show just wetlands pockmarking the whole landscape. And if you're living and depending on natural resources around you and directly utilizing them, especially as the Yakanuki people did back in the day pre-contact, they used as much as they could from any of the, say, like the mountains nearby down to the wetlands. So they had to learn all of these systems, and that knowledge becomes locked within traditional stories, teachings, and the language is all tied with it as well. And you have to learn how to manage all of these systems so that you don't overharvest and destroy, you know, one of your main, whether it be material sources or food sources. The wetlands played a huge role in that. They even had the sturgeon nose canoe, which is a unique design specific to the Kootenai people that was excellent for using within the wetlands and accessing all of these materials that they used in their everyday life. So a lot of culture and language developed specifically around these wetlands because they were so intertied and dependent on those systems for their daily life, that seeing the need for restoring these wetlands, back in, I think it was the mid-80s, they actually dedicated some of these areas to remaining wetlands. So I think that's why they partnered with Ducks Unlimited back in the day to kind of bring more protection, I guess you could say, to a wetland area. But throughout the years, the capacity to run these systems diminished. And that's when the need, say, for like the Friends of the Yakanuki Wetland Society came along, and they actually took care of it for a while, and they did excellent work out there. But it does take a lot of time and money and funding, continual funding, in order to keep these structures in place and functioning as intended. One of Tom's favorite sayings is, you can build a highway, but you need to maintain it. The same thing goes for these impoundments. You put them in place, if you have the millions and millions of dollars over time to keep them functioning, then it might be okay, but we don't have that money nor resources or capacity from Lower Kootenai Band. So it just made more sense to put them back to as close as naturally functioning as possible.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Try and structure and form these wetlands in a way that they'll be able to take care of themselves over time and be able to naturally function as they had before.
Yeah, and then having that back and not spending the time and money and man hours on trying to fix these areas, they can actually start focusing on the more cultural components to these areas. They can go out and start building those practices again, which some people still do. You know, they go out there and they'll utilize the area like they used to traditionally, whether it be for hunting or gathering materials. And there's language, there's culture, and the practice of doing these things is something that it's needed more than ever these days, where unfortunately the Lower Kootenai Band had just lost another elder this past week. So having that knowledge preserved is key for the local band and for the nation, and also for surrounding nations. Anything they do to preserve their land also helps to preserve part of their culture as well.
Wow. It seems like these wetlands have, first of all, said they play such a huge ecological role within the environment, and they also play such a huge cultural role within the communities that have been living and thriving in these areas for thousands of years.
Yeah.
What were some of the threats, concerns, or degradation to the land? What caused the wetland to become an unnatural place in the beginning?
Basically, these dams, the only thing that continued to function as intended from putting these dams in place was the floodwaters were kept out of these areas. And that, like I said, was meant to protect the nesting sites they were trying to create. And in doing so, they kept a lot of, like all of the water basically out. Anything that entered the systems was either pumped in or deposited through precipitation, like snow or rainfall. And when the floods did come up, waters were able to enter the system, but only like through seepage. Like these areas did fill up sometimes during the major floods. One point, there was a breach in one of the dams during one of the floods in, say, I think it was 2011, and water was able to enter the system that way. But other than that, there's no real connection between these enclosed compartments, compounds, and the river systems. So in taking these out, you know, that interplay between them for, you know, plants, animals, fish, bugs is lost. And they only continue to function for certain species. And that's good for certain species, but it devastates others. Everybody that has projects within the Kootenai River and Kootenai Lake systems, they're trying to get back the sturgeon and the burbot, but they also need to look at certain things like the kokanee. They're spawning added lots and lots of nutrients back to the system that was extremely beneficial for those types of fish. Like they're almost like, we know the sturgeon's a bottom feeder, the burbot. And in order to help bring back these listed species, we have to do and try as best as we can to create a holistic restoration for everything out there, because there is an interplay. There's a dependency on all of these components within the system, whether it be like the plants, the animals, the fish, bugs. They all need each other, and they all existed back in the day as part of one system. So if we can get that back, then we do help the listed species that are being targeted. So, yeah.
Thank you, Norm. Yeah, that's a great reminder of that connection between all these systems. So what work has the Yakanuki put into the wetlands so far? And what work is being done currently?
We've set it up as a series of phases, so that if we started it off as just one big project, then it would only get so far with limited funding. So if we've been able to design and phase it out so that we can complete certain sections that will function on their own as wetlands. And then we rotate through back with later funding through further phases. And we've been restoring up to, I think it's around 517 hectares of wetland. About 2/3 of that, we're actually trying to reopen to floodplain, maybe 3/4. And then the last quarter, we're actually trying to utilize other ways of filling it, say through like they have agricultural pumps, because there are fields nearby that we lease out for Timothy haying at the moment. And there's points of the year that they're pumping a lot of water out of these areas into the Kootenai River. So with the turn of a valve, we can actually run this water down another ditch into some of these wetlands, which will actually help pre-treat some of the water before it hits the system. And these areas are, this one in particular, we chose to do some of this work because it's chock full of invasive narrowleaf cattail. And yeah, we want to kind of start seeing what some of these things can do is, and wetlands are actually huge, huge filters for water systems as well. They take they're huge carbon sinks. They'll take lots of stuff out of some of these ditches before they hit the actual Kootenai River, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. And that's really cool. Kind of like the term I like to use, you're feeding two birds with one scone in that instance, pumping water out of the field, bringing it into the wetland, creating more habitat for wetland animals, and then also filtering that water before it runs back out into the Kootenai River.
Yeah.
Cool. So what do you see as your community's greatest strengths and limitations in doing the groundwork?
In the beginning, it was just the capacity to do it. But now, you know, building that capacity is becoming one of our bigger strengths because we're able to purchase an excavator that's geared towards rebuilding these wetlands. It's nice and light. It has wide tracks, its own little blade on the front. And one of the operators are from the community themselves. We're working on trying to get more of them. They've been able to purchase a truck and a trailer to transport this. So we're looking to get involved with wetland restoration throughout the community, through the valley, and even through the traditional lands, maybe even beyond. It's basically trying to get as much for the community that we can. We're working on other things. I'm going to do a little test planting myself in the areas with some band members from the community. This is a plan that I want to kind of, it's in the works at the moment, but we can start growing our own plants for the restoration itself, like some of the natural live cuttings. We can grow into more established trees that are called TRS cuttings, and they have a root ball on them, and we can go and plant those, maybe even some plugs or a small potted stock. And we actually have another project going on that we've put on hold for a bit, but now that we're finished a lot of this area, we took out like 2 kilometers of dam on one section, and we called it natural restored levee. These areas were stripped of a lot of the riparian vegetation that were there, so we plan on going back through with the same kind of phasing and replanting these areas to help reestablish that riparian area. And yeah, so building the capacity for the community is something that plays a huge role in these projects.
Wow, that sounds like good news that capacity is being built and that you're able to revisit these old projects. I'm glad to hear. On our site visit, we noticed that the area is really big and there's a lot of different morphologies on the landscape. How do you keep the big picture organized in your mind while dealing with these very specific little regions during your restoration?
It's through the phasing. Each time we go back, we can see what's currently working for the previous phases and start implementing some of that into the newer projects. Like say last year, we had built a bunch of wetlands in the area, and we're reconnecting a 1.2 kilometer loop of stream that was cut off, and they dug a ditch from one loop to the other in order to put the dam in place. And when we restored that area, we left all of our inlets and outlets at too high of an elevation. So during freshet, it flooded in there, but it didn't have access to that water for as long as just beyond the loop did. And wetlands at the same elevation were drastically different. Inside of the loop, we could see that they were dry. And the bottom of this massive historical wetland in that basin was also dry, and it had a lot of canary reed in it. But outside the loop, the wetland had about two feet of water, maybe a foot and a half, to some of the same ones that we constructed on the inner loop. And larger basins of the historical wetlands that were dry last year and just had like dried out spike rush at the bottom that was only a few inches tall were full of burr reed this year. And all of that, and then around the edges last year was chock full of Bidens, the beggar's tick. And we could start to see the effect of having an area open to floodplain versus not open. So we're able to go in and put those elevations of the inlet for that island that was there at a lower elevation so that the water would have access longer during freshet. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to like wrap my head around some of those ideas of just like watching how the water moves through the system, and that's kind of how you get that bigger picture of how everything works.
Yeah. And in doing like the phasing that I was saying, we can say like we added an inlet this year that only needs a 25 centimeter raise in the water behind it before it's flooding the whole area. And we could have put the rest of the historical inlets and outlets that we opened up to that same elevation, but then it'd add a lot of different variables to it as well. So in doing these phasings throughout the year, we can make these changes and keep track of how they're affecting the system. And if they're having positive effects, then we can start duplicating that. Or if they're being detrimental to, you know, the outcomes of what we want for the area, we can reverse those. Say like if some of the inlets we put in are too low and we're starting to see more erosion than we wanted, we can go back at a drier time and put in like a core trench across these areas and raise that inlet to, you know, whatever elevation we want so that it doesn't affect negatively.
Wow, that's kind of cool. Seems like a lot of work, but it seems really cool how you can just those are slight changes in elevation and just slightly heightening and lowering the inlet and the outlet will determine huge things like erosion and flooding. And it's so cool.
Yeah.
Anyways, besides kind of what you were mentioning with in some of the invasive species that you're starting to see encroach within the wetlands, are there other concerns impacting ecological well-being within the wetlands? And if so, how are these concerns being addressed?
Say with the plants, the elevations are also key. These islands, because the area wasn't being flooded, they were a higher elevation, which became havens for invasives. Same with the dams and along some of the levees as well, the natural levee. So in removing a lot of these higher areas, we're able to spread the dirt out. And within about a meter and a half to 2 meters elevation change, about every half meter, we're starting to see different things. Like the bottom would be like the sedges and natural grasses and everything that you see within the wetland. A half meter up, you'd see the natural grasses that surround it. And then up to another half meter, we'd see the canary reed, which is like just so dense. We flew LIDAR before the project and it didn't penetrate it. Our readings for elevations off by a meter and a half to 2 meters. And about a meter higher than that, we're starting to see some of the more natural grasses appear. So we're able to take a lot of our dirt spoils and lay them out on that canary reed layer and bring that elevation up and use a lot of the natural grasses that are appearing at that higher elevation to seed those areas. And we're not seeing those being dominated by a canary reed even a year to 2.5 years later. We're seeing those natural grasses that we planted and some invasives that we need to take care of, but it was a little difficult this year with everything being shut down because of the pandemic going on. We weren't able to go out in the early season and take care of a lot of these invasives. So they've spread a little bit, but we've got plans on, usually it's a lot of mechanical removal. We'll go in, we've got tractors with mower decks, we've got flail mowers, brush saws, and we can utilize some of the crews now to go in and start taking care of these invasives. And then we just have plans to, we always keep in the plan to have areas that we might need to reseed. So, yeah.
Wow. So is invasive species like the biggest concern that you're seeing then?
At the moment, yes. But we are seeing, we're starting to see that with the side that we'd restored last year to floodplain, we're seeing the migration of the plants throughout the elevations that I was talking about. Like we're starting to see more wetter plants like the burr reed appear on the bottoms. The bidens are starting to appear more in the canary reed areas, which are starting to be more stunted. because it's a bit wetter throughout the year now, and we're starting to see those natural grasses at a higher elevation just basically are starting to become more and more healthy. So monitoring all this stuff is key. Or we're trying to like monitor for as much as we can in order to start seeing anything that might be negatively affecting the project. Say like there's all of a sudden like an introduced species taking over the area, we can go back and adjust. Like I was saying, all these wetlands were connected through ditching and we filled those ditches back up. But in doing so, we did an elevation that kept them as spillways so that when the higher elevation wetlands fill up, they'll spill over into the next one and so on throughout the area. So we can start adjusting those things to see like whether or not we can start affecting anything that might negatively impact the area, say like an invasive species. We know this year there's been massive efforts that have been gone on for the control of the bullfrog, and counts are down this year. So it's having relationships and ties with all of those other projects that are going on that help key us into whether or not we need to start looking at, say, like if there's a population boom in bullfrogs, you know, we need to possibly figure out if the temperature is perfect or if we created better habitat for them, then we may need to adjust some of that. So, yeah, and all of that will show up within, we've got a 5-year monitoring plan in place at the moment, and that'll give us a short term look at the place. Eventually, my dream is to have a 20-year plan together, because then all of the different flood regimes have gone through and a lot of these flood regimes have repeated themselves throughout the area, and you start to see the effects of the work we've been doing on this, in restoring this floodplain.
Yeah, it's interesting. You're trying to create a bit of almost like a herd immunity between the other organizations in the region against species like the bullfrog. And trying to keep each other up to date, constantly making sure that we're managing for this and planning. And it made me think and wonder, like how much is climate change on your radar? I guess we're expected to see some increased flooding. Are the management plans in place taking that into account?
Currently, we're just trying to work with the systems that are here. We know we will be getting more flooding, and historically, there was up to 22 feet of water that used to flood the valley. Sometimes there'd be so much water that the Kootenai River would reverse its flow back towards Bonners.
Wow.
So we know that these systems used to deal with massive amounts of water, but we're restoring it back to utilize what we have currently. A lot of the flooding's now regulated by like the Libby Dam. We're expecting larger snowpacks this year, and in the spring we could get rain on snow events that will be a cause of like a lot of flooding. So in opening these massive areas to floodplain, it actually creates almost a pressure release on the system, because the water could come in and it can actually spread itself out. You can't compress water. So if you do something like cut off these loops and you have more water introduced into the systems, it speeds up. It's like running down a pipe. All this water will just travel faster and create that much more of a problem throughout the whole system. But if you add this, it takes a lot of that pressure out. Say these massive floodplains, because it gives water somewhere to go rather than just complete, you know, the continual flow down these old streams that are either blocked off by diking or they've been deepened as well by head cuts traveling up the streams. So
yeah, definitely. Wetlands are so important for flood control, to act as like a water storage for all that additional water that gets inserted into the system. I guess probably one of the bigger concerns regarding climate change in wetlands is the decreased water availability in the summertime and increased probability of drought and dry up in the wetlands then. So What species depend on these wetlands, specifically species at risk? What animals are you seeing in there, and which ones are you really managing for? Which are the ones of primary interest?
And what we're seeing is a lot of Western painted turtle. We've included all of our construction that we've been doing in a feasibility study for whether or not the northern leopard frog has enough habitat to come back on their own or if they need to start reintroducing. We've just started working with the Kootenai tribe of Idaho, but we weren't able to get into as depth this year. They have fisheries that do the burbot and sturgeon releases in Canada, but because everything shut down, and I'm sure as everybody's been doing, we've been trying to scramble and make sure that we can get as many of our own projects going as we can. And we just got really busy with that as well. And with the border closing, we weren't able to meet and go over some more objectives that we want for the future, but they did lend FLINRO a number of data and telemetry receivers and temperature loggers. The telemetry receivers record what types of fish go through that are tagged. And we put one of those in the south channel near the mouth. It's recording the temperatures and what fish are starting to utilize the system. And if we're starting to see more and more of the targeted or listed species going upstream, then we are looking at putting some temp loggers within the wetlands themselves and possibly doing burbot or sturgeon releases within those wetlands to see. And they track them genetically. So even a few generations from now, if they catch a burbot or sturgeon in the system, they can take a piece of, I forget what they take, but they're able to take like a DNA test on them to see whether or not they're related to the fish that were released within the wetlands, or they're part of some other release that they've done, or they're wholly natural from whatever existed in the system itself. So this is the first year we've kind of looked at what's happening with the area, because we started some of the wetland reconstruction in the fall of 2017. Then 2018, we basically built from the beginning of August all the way up to November, we were doing construction. So now it's kind of been the first year that we've started monitoring the areas, and a lot of that information still is being processed at the moment, and that'll give us a look at what's coming back. And then we can actually see, like I was saying, through these phases, what we can implement in the future work that we're going to do to help these species.
Wow, that's great to hear. A lot of technical aspects to that too. Really interesting. What are the hopes or goals with this land? Are there any specific priorities that you guys have on your agenda as you're planning for next steps?
Just to reintroduce the systems, the rivers and streams back to the floodplain is really one of the key components. Restoring it back to as naturally functioning as possible, even though because of the water levels, like the Kootenai River has dropped in elevation because it's deeper. The Libby dams are in place, and same with some of the other dams. They keep a lot of that water and floodwaters regulated. But if we can get it back to where it floods almost every year, like it used to, then the systems will start taking care of themselves naturally. And we don't have to come in every 20 years and spend millions rebuilding dams, or every 5 to 10 years spending like tens of thousands putting in and replacing water control structures, and you know, even thousands a year on running pumps to keep these areas flooded. We're trying to get away from all of those costs. And the added benefit is that those systems start functioning and taking care of themselves and adding back to, you know, the Kootenai Lake, the river, Goat River, and all of these other systems that, you know, a lot of people throughout the valley all the way even down into the states are working really hard to bring back.
Thank you, Norm. Those are some great incentives to keep you going. And for me, it's really nice to hear that you're trying to restore it back to its natural state. It makes so much more sense cost-wise, and then for self-reliance in the system. So I have one last question for you, Norm. What is your favorite or what is the most rewarding part of your job?
It's a number of things. There's like so much going on with it that, seeing community members that have worked on some of these areas, you know, they'll talk about bringing their grandkids through and like, you know, I worked on this, and they're talking about walking them through forests in the area or naturally restored wetlands. Some community members were actually, they told me they were tearing up because they haven't seen that many ducks on the flats on the reserve since like 30, 40 years ago. And hearing things and how important it is to the community is probably on the top of the list, and having them become more and more involved with it, finding ways to involve them more is like, it becomes more rewarding because they build the ownership over it and they start to see the value of what it means to themselves. That's probably key. Another one is, like I grew up with puzzles and like the metal little puzzles you'd get like with the horseshoes and the ring, or you'd have to separate certain things. I used to love doing those all throughout my youth. So, and I still do a bunch today, but fitting everything together has been a lot of fun, meeting all of these people that have just immense passion for a lot of the work. Like Tom Babykauser is like, he'll talk from the moment he wakes up till he goes to sleep about wetlands for years and years. Even now, I'm still like, we've been working together for almost 4 years now, 3-4 years, and there's still things he's telling me about wetlands and knowledge that he's had learned throughout his career. And yeah, just seeing his passion and for restoring these areas now, and it's kind of infectious. And you know, being able to build capacity for the band as well is it's awesome, because the band can actually have meaningful work for the band members to come in and do stuff. Not that they don't with all the other stuff going on. This is just another addition to helping the band out as well, build the capacity so that it can actually start being more self-reliant, I guess you could say.
Oh, those are such great rewards, and I can see it through the way that you talk, like how much this really means to you. And it's so good to hear that it's bringing these values and these benefits to the community. Seems like it's so beneficial for all that depend on it, the animals and the plants and the people and the culture that's everlasting around these wetlands. And it's so great to hear that. Thank you, Norm, for sharing that. That's really great to hear. It's really sweet.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today, Norm. I appreciate it a lot, and I've learned so much.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's always a pleasure. As much as we can, share this with the community in as many ways as we can, we're trying to with other people like off of the reserve and surrounding areas as well. We're finding it's something that's beneficial to everybody, not just the community. So
yeah, it really is beneficial to all of us, especially those who are local to the area. We depend on these systems, and they have long, everlasting effects on the ecology and the climate, and even probably impacts on our economy and the way that we live in our societies. Like, I mean, it's integral. And so I want to thank you for this effort that you're putting into this and your constant passions and the work that you're doing to help the land on which we all depend.
Thank you. I'm glad. I'm extremely lucky to be part of something like this. Like, yeah, it's rewarding. Like, I'm just kind of lucky in the sense that I get to be a part of all of this that goes on. It's a massive effort put on by everybody involved in order to undertake something like this. So, and to have everybody involved, just seeing their passion either awaken or already exist because of the project or through previous work or interests they have is, it's amazing.
It is amazing. Well, I'm glad that you're enjoying it, because I want to come on another field tour one of these days.
Yeah, when I'm sure there'll be more tours through the area, especially as it, you know, as it progresses. Everything we do, like some of the things we've done, have drastically changed the area from one phase to the next. So, yeah, it's always something to kind of come back and look at.
Well, thank you again, Norm. It's been really great talking to you, and I hope you have a really great rest of your day.
Thank you for tuning in to Voices of the Lake. As always, you can follow Friends of Kootenai Lake on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for ongoing updates on our projects and programs.
Huge thanks to our funders, the Osprey Community Foundation, Regional District of Central Kootenai, and Nelson District Credit Union for helping us bring these stories to you. Again, you're listening to Sliver of Sunshine by Born on a Wednesday. Check them out on Spotify, Bandcamp, their website, bornonawednesday.com, and their Instagram page, Born on a Wednesday Music. Thank you, Born on a Wednesday crew. We love your stuff. Go check them out. Kind of like the way my spirits rise up when that sunlight hits my face. Gotta find me a sliver of sunshine. Gotta break free of this belly fall.